For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Slate Money is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. Get information about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy on the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes. And by SAP HANA. SAP HANA helps the world's best companies get the answers they need to become more agile, develop new streams of revenue, and predict the future. Run SAP and run simple. Visit sap.com/reimagine to learn more. And by Mile IQ. If you're one of the 60 million Americans who drive for work, then you know that your miles are your dollars. Every mile you don't log is money that you are losing. Mile IQ is the only mileage tracker app that detects, logs, and calculates your miles for you, ensuring that every mile is accounted for and no dollar is lost. Try Mile IQ for free today by texting Slate Money to 31996. That's Slate Money to 31996.
Hello, and welcome to the How the Other Half Banks edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. Many apologies for not coming out on Saturday as we normally do. This is a slightly delayed episode, but the reason is an incredibly good reason, and you might have worked it out already from the title of the show. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined, as always, by Cathy O'Neill, the data scientist and blogger at mathbabe.org.
Hello.
Hello, Cathy. I'm joined, as always, by Jordan Weissman, the Moneybox columnist at Slate.
I'd just like to point out for the listeners at home that Cathy was doing a wonderful little hula as she was being introduced. These are the thing. Really, we need to become the Slate Money cast.
I learned to hula when I was on vacation in Hawaii.
Wait,
I am
did?
Excellent at it.
He's also going to, Felix is going to demonstrate this later. I'll sing. It'll be great.
Anyway. And Jordan.
Yes.
We have a special guest this week.
Yes.
We have with us the author of the new book, How the Other Half Banks, and she is a law professor at the University of Georgia, Marissa Baradaran.
Say that three times now.
Baradaran.
Okay.
Baradaran.
So Marissa, just to bring this back to reality, has written this book. The subtitle is, because all nonfiction books in America need subtitles.
It's true.
Exclusion, Exploitation, and the Threat to Democracy. So there's, you know, your light reading for the weekend. Yeah. We are going to be spending this entire episode basically talking about a few of the many, many issues which Marissa brings up in this book. Jordan.
Yeah, so I just want to start off by saying it's a great book. I very much enjoyed reading it. And for the big topic of the book is essentially why so many Americans do not have access to the mainstream financial system. And it's a great book, not because it just describes the plight of Americans today and possible ways to fix it, but it's kind of this neat intellectual history of banking in America and how the banking system got to be what it is now. And so I guess I want to start off with a stat that you kind of include in the book, or a couple stats. The first one is that there are approximately 70 million Americans now who do not have a bank account or access to traditional financial services. 70 million Americans, that's a huge part of the population. And then we typically think, I think most listeners, when they think of someone who doesn't have a bank account, they think someone who's poor, below the poverty line. But you're right, you point out that these are actually people making up to like $45,000 a year. This is working class Americans for the most part, or working class and poor. So my question is, how did it get so bad? Why are so many people cut off from the mainstream financial system in this country?
Sure. So I think unbanked is actually a little bit under-inclusive because there's there are unbanked and then there are people who are sort of underbanked or unhappily banked or unsatisfactorily banked, right?
Well, that's 100% of the population.
Well, yeah, okay. Right. So a lot of people have a bank account, but they don't use it because it's too expensive for them. So maybe they have some relationship with some bank, but when they have credit needs or even transactional needs, they go outside of the banking system. So how did this come to be? Well, the banks just stopped serving low deposit, low income folks. And there's this long history, as you saw in the book, of this, you know, conglomeration of banking and this speedy market of mergers and acquisitions that left community banks very vulnerable to, you know, being sucked into Bank of America or just closing down their doors. And so you have a lot of these neighborhoods, mostly in inner city or rural areas, that are not as high profit as other areas.
So banking is in the United States, at least, in most countries as well, most countries, a for-profit industry. It makes billions and billions of dollars a year in profit. And if you're a for-profit industry, it doesn't actually make sense to bank people who are earning much less than $45,000 a year, just because banking people is expensive, right?
Yeah, and you have the same overhead costs if you're taking in like $100,000 of deposits versus $500 of deposits. And so you're more likely to make a profit, obviously, lending that $100,000 than the $500. And so you're going to try to get high net worth individuals. And so that's where banks have congregated up the income ladder.
So, I mean, one of the things that was really cool about reading this book is it explained to me what had happened in my own life as someone who uses banks, right? When I finished high school, I started an account at, I think it was the Harvard Co-op Bank. It was like very, very local in like Cambridge. And, you know, then it was acquired by Fleet Bank and then Bank of Boston. And it just went through all these different
mergers. So now you're Bank of America.
Bank of America. Yeah, thank exactly. you. Yes. And it, like what, I mean, so you explained why that happened. And it's exactly what you and Felix were just mentioning. But you also explained sort of the opposite of it, which is that when banks had more restrictions on location and where they could open up branches, it actually did make sense for them to bank the poor. Can you explain that too?
Yeah. So for 200 years of our history until relatively recently, right? So this is a brand new phenomenon, payday lending. There were no payday lenders before like 1980, 1990. And since then, the industry has sort of flourished because of this gap. But for 200 years of our history, banks had essentially monopoly in a certain region. So there's this thing called unit banking. And so if you are a bank in, Chelsea, this is all you have, just Chelsea. You can't branch in Harlem or, outside the state, definitely. And so starting in 1990, to the Rigel-Neal Interstate Banking Act. And a little bit before then, you start having nationwide expansion. And once you have a Bank of America-like thing, you start sucking up all these other community banks. And so your co-op in Harvard was bought quickly by some other, maybe Massachusetts bank, and then all of a sudden it's owned by Bank of America.
So I want to talk a bit more about this question of payday lending, or rather, I know that Jordan wants to talk a bit more about payday lending. But just to be clear, in order to get a payday loan, you do need to have a bank account.
Yes, absolutely. You need a checking account and you need a paycheck. So this is not the destitute. It's not the sort of, payday loans are not going to like the homeless or the real sort of impoverished.
But so there's a huge overlap between, within those 70 million people who are underbanked, there's a lot of people. Virtually all of the people getting payday loans are in that 70 million, but they all have checking accounts of some description.
It's much more than 70 million. So 70 million, I think, is the unbanked, those who have no access
to banking. And so they don't even have access to payday loans.
That's right.
And so the underbanked, the people, if you include all the people who are getting payday loans, it's much bigger even than that.
Huge. I mean, it's anywhere from 20 to 40% of the population relies on payday loans if they have some credit need. There's a Federal Reserve statistic that says that half the population couldn't access $400 within a month time frame without selling something or borrowing. Now, usually people can go to friends and family, but those of us who can't, or I mean, I can, but many people who cannot have to go to a payday lender.
Yeah. So a little step back for a little, I guess, review. I mean, I'm sure most of people listening have heard of payday loans, hopefully haven't had to use one, but maybe have, since as we're talking, a lot of their customers are actually middle class, which is something that kind of gets lost in this discussion. But, what is a payday loan? Well, it's essentially a small loan, a few hundred dollars maybe. You go to this storefront operation, you give them access to your bank account, and they're charging you in very, very high, some would say usurious interest rates. And they, you know, we're talking 300% in some cases. And they withdraw, again, directly from your bank account on payday. That's where the name comes from. So you write in your book that there have been all these attempts to kind of deal with this problem and come up with substitutes and kind of chase the payday lenders out, but they don't disappear because there's a need for their product. And no matter what, it seems like there hasn't been a case where someone's really figured out a workable replacement. Can you just discuss that? And why has it been so hard to find a workable replacement?
Yeah, so there's this huge demand. I mean, I don't know if you saw the John Oliver show on payday lending, and he and Sarah Silverman do this hilarious skit at the end where, like, you know, if you need a payday loan, literally do anything else, you know? And I think that's the problem, is there literally is nothing else. There are no other options. And I think that's why it's been so difficult to regulate this industry. You know, it's like cat and mouse or whack-a-mole or whatever you want to call it. As soon as you sort of cap interest rates or ban payday lending. In Georgia, the state that I live in, payday lending is banned. There are no such thing as a payday loan. However, we have essentially payday loans. You know, we have title loans, which are much worse than payday loans, because not only do you pay, you know, 1,000% APR, but you also lose your car. You know, we've got pawn, and pawn is actually the least, you know, usurious and sharkish of the bunch. But there's installment lenders. There's all sorts of replacement payday loans. And then there's, you know, fees that pop up where interest is capped, or quote unquote insurance products that end up, you know, driving the price higher. So it's just a very hard industry to regulate.
It's worth noting that, like, if you're looking at these things on an interest rate level, and one of the reasons why payday loans have a really bad sort of PR problem is because if you calculate the APR, it's always going to look bad because you're borrowing for a week. And if you calculate, if you only pay like $2 in interest, but you'd pay it back in a week, then the APR could be hundreds of percent. And so that kind of explains things, because if you look at overdrafts, a lot of those, if you work out the effective APR, is like 3,000% as well.
The one thing, though, and I think you bring this up in the book, is that people aren't really only borrowing for a week, because they end up rolling over these loans over and over and over again. And so a week becomes 10 weeks, becomes a year in some cases. So they end up paying that ridiculous APR.
And they're meant to be rolled over. I mean, 85 to 90% of people get more than one loan. 20% or so get more than 10 loans in a row. And that's the model of the business, right? So even with baked into the model is this repeat loan.
So,
and also, I mean, you make the point that there's some states that actually regulate how many rollovers you can have.
Right.
But also that's not going to address it. If you're just trying to like whack the mole,
right,
you're not actually addressing like what these middle class people need the money, because they don't have enough savings
so
to put themselves through.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
But I did want to ask a really quick question. Going back to the Felix comment, if payday loans aren't available to people without bank accounts, where do unbanked people get loans? Emergency loans.
If payday, so that's where the title loans come in. The pawn, if you have something to pawn, that's probably the best
option.
And
there's also like, and I can tell you this, and we're going to probably mention credit unions at some point. As a former board member of the Lower East Side People's Federal Credit Union, which is mentioned in the book, I'm glad to say, our customers went to loan sharks, good old-fashioned loan sharks, who aren't even legal, don't even pretend to be legal. But what we would find a lot of the time, and we knew this was going on, and we were still happy to give them a loan, a lot of our loans were basically refinancing loan sharks. And it's much better, obviously, to get a loan from the credit union than it is to just stay and hock to the loan shark.
You know, while we're talking about credit unions, this was part of the book that maybe depressed me most in a way. And I guess there's a little personal part, because one of the first stories, when I was in my intern days at the Washington Post, one of my first stories, decent stories I thought at the time I wrote, was about how Washington had banned payday lenders and they were working with the credit unions locally to come up with replacement products. And that was back in 2008. And there was like some federal program going on to try and convince banks to start giving out these small loans. And
the FDIC program.
Yeah, exactly. And basically you say that it all failed. And so why is it that credit unions, I mean, have not been able to step into the gap a little bit more here? Like, is it just lack of interest? Is there logistics? What is it?
Look, I mean, the credit union was born in an era where community banking was king, and it was protected. You know, credit unions were, you know, they're, you know, 1907 or 10 invention, or I mean, even earlier than that, right? These are about communities, as their name indicates, right? Communities joining together, forming a union, right? So there's this small group of, you know, people who knew each other, and they were driving down the cost of the loan because you could, you know, use your knowledge of this person as this is a good guy, work with him, and instead of charging a high interest. But credit unions, that model just doesn't work anymore. We don't have it. Look, I bank at a credit union. And if you're going to choose bank versus credit union, probably go with a credit union. But it's not going to serve the problem that I'm outlining in this book. I mean, this is a huge problem. Credit unions, and the credit union that you're part of is a great one, but there's only about 200 in the country.
So we're going to, you have a potential solution to this, mm-hmm. which we're going to come to in a minute.
Yes.
But first, Slate Money is sponsored this week by SAP HANA. SAP HANA helps the world's best companies get the answers they need to become more agile, develop new streams of revenue, and predict the future. Run SAP and run simple. Visit sap.com/reimagine to learn more. Kathy.
Yes. Yeah, I get to talk to you about the good news, which is that you have a solution. Before we get to the solution, though, I want to back up to sort of the biggest theme in your book that really surprised me, because I'm not a historian of finance and I don't know how things worked earlier in this country. But you explained that banking as an industry was sort of invented by the government as a way to serve the poor. I mean, so it specifically wasn't invented. I'm simplifying, but you should correct me. But it wasn't invented as a profit-making industry. It was invented to be a tool of the government to serve the needs of the people and to extend credit and help savings.
Okay. Yeah. The only correction I want to make is not for the poor necessarily, but for the people.
For the people,
yes.
I should say. The
yes.
public.
The public. Yeah. And I think this goes back to sort of the Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson debate that, you know, is very much in the founding of our country. And Alexander Hamilton, as a soldier in the Revolutionary War, is very much concerned about the country's finances. And so that's where banking originates in the States. But even if you go, you know, to the old world where Felix is from, you know, every modern banking industry, every modern bank has its roots within a government partnership. And bank notes start as government IOUs. And so there is this sense that the public needs credit. And so the government's going to form a bank to push this credit out into the public. Now, it wasn't necessarily the poor, but it was the common people, right?
And the farmers.
Exactly, the agrarians. And this is Jefferson's very sort of, you know, we're going to be this agrarian nation and we need small credit that doesn't conglomerate in Washington and New York, but goes out to, you know, the real future of this country, which is the agrarian West and South. And by West, it was like Virginia.
And so that was actually why the original rules of like you can't bank outside a certain region were created, because they are actually afraid of exactly the too big to fail scenario.
And that actually also helps to explain, which is something I feel that a lot of Americans don't understand. That for all that Bernie Sanders starts complaining about how unbelievably concentrated the American banking system and four banks have 35% of the assets or whatever, America has by far the most fragmented and least concentrated banking system of any major country in the world. Most countries have two or three banks tops. And there is no national bank in America. There's no bank which is in all 50 states. And this all comes from this Jeffersonian idea.
That's right. And it was by design, and it was purposefully meant to cap bank power and influence, right? And so that's Jefferson's worst nightmare, which maybe we're living in, not quite yet, but we still have the most fragmented banking system. We also have federal banking and state banking. We're the only country that has that, and that's also very
Jeffersonian. We also have 12 different central banks, which makes
yeah,
no sense.
Six agencies. You've got the FDIC, the OCC, you know, the Fed.
Essentially, the Federal Reserve system is a system of 12 different central banks. Like, why can't we just have one central bank?
You know, it was a compromise.
Marissa really explained that very well, and I urge everyone to read this book. It's very fascinating.
It's great. Yeah, I just say a lot of people forget that like something like banking does have an intellectual history. Like people like economics in general, like people forget that. But like it was really cool to see how we went from the idea that okay, banks should only be allowed to serve farmers in this one region because that's what we want them to do, to today where it's, you know, laissez-faire uber alles.
Right, and I think that's what got lost is we may have, so maybe Thomas Jefferson was actually wrong, right? I mean, Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson certainly were wrong that in their prescriptions, right? So Jefferson says we're going to be an agrarian nation. Well, not quite. We're an industrial power. Jackson says the central bank is going to be the enemy of the common man. Not quite, right? Because of a lack of central bank, we had sort of unregulated Wall Street excesses that led to the Great Depression. But their fears were dead on. And there was this debate about how best to organize banking to help the people. But there was never the sense of, like, how are we best going to help banks to make the most money? And
Now, I want to move on to your proposed solution, which is actually a bank which operates in all 50 states. The first national, genuinely American bank.
And it's something that's already happened.
That's right. And I think it's a conceding that, Alexander Hamilton was right and that we are living in a national banking era. It's not, community banking, as great as it was, we're just not going to allow monopolies anymore to these regional small banks. And so, look, what do we have in all 50 states that is in every community? And it's the post office. And it is something that we did successfully for 50 years and that every other developed country does. It's really not a radical idea whatsoever.
So I think we, just to restate for people who haven't listened to the book, the idea specifically is to have postal banking. That's what it's called. It's that literally the bank, the post office, which right now has all sorts of revenue problems, so they could probably use the sideline business, but becomes a national bank for low income or unbanked middle income Americans.
Well, for anyone who wants it, yeah. But the people who are going to use it are going to be the immigrants, yeah, and the poor and the lower classes. But every single person listening to this podcast who's ever lived in any country other than the USA knows exactly what we're talking about here.
That's right. Evan, if you lived in the U.S. from 1910 to 1966, you would also know what we were talking about. And that's, you go to your post office. Currently, you can actually get money orders at the post office. So it's not a stretch. They're already dealing in cash. But you'd essentially have an account at the post office. You could get your, debit card from there. The ATM would be there. You would, take your paycheck to the post office, and then you could have some checking account or something like that. And again, this is something that it just wouldn't be a stretch and would add needed revenue to the post office.
So, but however, we did have it and it mm-hmm. closed. So yeah. Can we talk about what happened there and why it won't happen again?
Okay. Well, I'm not quite as pessimistic, but it closed in 1966, and that was the golden era of community banking. It was also the era of least sort of income inequality in the United States. I don't know if you've read Piketty's Capital, but there was this flattening of disparities, and we had a community bank in every region. And the community banks at the time, because of Reg Q and all these banking laws, were able to give 3% return on your deposits. Remember back when we used to get interest on deposits?
No,
we do not live in that world, and probably will likely never live in that world again. But back then, you would get 3% on your deposits, and the post office was capped at 2.5%.
For political reasons.
For political reasons, that's right, to get passed.
So basically we're saying community banks serve the purpose that postal bank.
Every community essentially had a community bank and a postal bank, and the community banks were paying more interest, and so all of the money drained out of the postal banks went into the community banks. And there really wasn't a need for them. Now, two decades later, all of those community banks shut down or left, and the post offices remained, but without any banking functions.
Is the postal bank, if we get it started again, which I'm really excited about, mm-hmm. would they also extend loans, extend credit to the public, and how would they do that?
Yeah, so I think that they should, because there's a huge demand, and this is something, credit is something that the federal government is already so into, that I think this would be a nice extension of all of those facilities that we provide for the middle class and the higher classes.
Well, and one way you could do that is, again, putting on my Englishman hat, what I call the English overdraft. American overdrafts are evil things, and you go one penny overdrawn and they slap you with a $35 fee, and then you write another check or use your debit card and you get another $35 fee, and there's all manner of penalties. Whereas in England, the overdraft is just a negative balance on your checking account. So you open up a bank account at the post office and you're allowed to have a negative balance and up to a certain limit. And when there's a negative balance, you pay interest at some predetermined non-usurious interest rate. And then when you deposit more money back into the bank account, that negative balance goes away. And you can fluctuate above and below zero over time. And this is a way of extending immediate credit to people without having to charge crazy interest rates or do crazy underwriting.
So I have a question for really anyone who can answer it. But Felix, you mentioned that America's the only country without its own postal bank, essentially. Everyone else has figured this out by us. Do England or other countries have an unbanked population nonetheless? I mean, has postal banking actually solved this problem there, or does it still...
So England has a company called Wonga, which is notorious for doing crazy online payday loans, basically. Of course, there's always going to be demand for credit. And I don't think that a postal bank is realistically going to be able to solve all poor people's need for credit. It will, however, bank them. And okay. What you don't have in England or Germany or Spain or Canada or places like this are massive unbanked populations of people who don't even have a bank account, so they can't even Venmo money to each other.
Okay.
Right. I mean, there's postal banks for every country, every different model of postal banking. And so some are focused on financial inclusion. So Japan and Germany famously sort of encouraged thrift for the last 100 years. And so they had these small bank accounts. And really, I mean, some people credit their culture of savings to the postal banks. Sheldon Guerin, who's a historian at Princeton, has written this book called Beyond Our Means and very much makes that case. Like, we just didn't have this apparatus, and Germany and Japan did. And so I think there's a model for every country that you have out there. And it's really hard actually to compare our banking system to anywhere else or the level of poverty that we have and inequality. Not that we're worse, but we're just very different. And our banking system, as we just talked about, is very different than any other country.
So I have one more question, and I don't know if there's a good answer here, but we're talking about postal banking, and wonks love this idea because it seems to solve so many of these problems we've discussed at the root cause, you know. But it's hard to imagine something that's ever passing with a Republican-controlled Congress or a Republican presidency, really Republican-controlled anything in the United States, because the animosity towards expanding the government in any way.
Or even the Democrats.
Or most, for that matter, yeah, that's very true. There are a lot of Democrats who would bristle at this. So is there a second best option?
Okay, let me talk about that political economy question. One is, look, there are some different things going on here with the postal banks that maybe aren't involved in just government expansion. One is, I don't think we're talking about a lot of excess subsidies. We're not actually asking for any more money. It's just the retooling the given the structure that exists. And two, there's a lot of rural areas in this country that the post office is your only access to the federal government or the government, period. And so I don't know if they're going to be okay with losing that last sort of, you know, branch. And you know, a lot of rural areas, that post office is the center of town. And so there might be some aligning here of rural district people who may come to the post office's defense here. So I don't think it's a done deal. The other thing you have to sort of convince the bankers here to have them back off is that we're not taking your customers. You know, if anything, we'll graduate them into your banks, which is how postal banking got passed in the first place, is to convince bankers these are poor people's banks.
But we are hopefully taking away payday lender customers.
Yes.
Okay. So I have a second best.
Yeah. Second bet, let's hear it.
Which I'm going to come to, but first I'm going to talk about my sponsor. We are also sponsored this week by MileIQ, which is a great way to get basically free money. If you have a car, which most of you do, because that's where you listen to your podcasts, I know, and if you use that car to drive on business, for any kind of business, you are eligible for reimbursement at pretty standard rates, and I know you because you're lazy, you don't ever bother to file for it, or you don't know how to add it up, or it's a lot of work, or whatever. All you need to do is download MileIQ on your phone, and it will do everything for you. It will work out where you've driven, how far you've driven, how much money you need, everything. You just say, this was personal, this was business, bang, done. And you get hundreds of dollars. The average MileIQ user logs $547 a month in drives. $547 a month. So pick up this free money, which is sitting in your garage. MileIQ is the only mileage tracker app which will detect and log and calculate your drives for you automatically. And it's not just me saying this. It has a 5-star rating in both the Google Play and the iTunes app stores. You have no reason not to download this thing. Try MileIQ for free today by texting SLATEMONEY to 31996. That's SLATEMONEY to 31996. So, Mercer, this is the thing which I really wanted to talk to you about is debit cards. And you summarily write them off quite quickly in your book. You say, yeah, well, prepaid debit cards, in theory, perhaps, no, they don't work. Move on. This is why we need a post office bank.
But she's actually really good at writing things off that well. She does.
It was
boom,
it was
boom, boom.
Quickly dispatched.
Quickly dispatched. And I'm gonna try and resuscitate these poor malign debit cards from the grave you dug for them.
In my defense, I had like 85,000 words, which I actually pushed to 100,000, and I had to cover all of U.S. banking history. So debit cards did not get a whole chapter.
But... you know, if we're going to accept, you know, arguendo, Jordan's premise that the postal bank is not going to happen, then, and we can probably accept the premise that Walmart isn't going to become a bank either, which is effectively the same thing. It's the thing which is in every local community and frankly, should be a bank. In the UK, the supermarket's a bank. You know, Sainsbury's, the big supermarket is a bank. And that's a great way of banking. Because,
just to back up, like Walmart applied to become a bank and was rejected basically for political reasons.
And Walmart is a bank in Mexico, and it's a very good bank in Mexico, which does a very good job of banking the poor in Mexico. And
it's doing a good job here, too, by the way. Walmart is already offering great
products. And the great product which Walmart is offering is this thing called Bluebird, which is a prepaid debit card. And prepaid debit cards have evolved in the past few years to do basically everything that a checking account can do. You get your paycheck paid directly into them, and you can, you know, Venmo money to people, you can wire money, you can even, you can't borrow money from them, but you can do everything else. And in fact, not borrowing money from them is a feature rather than a bug. It means that you will never incur those overdraft fees and or anything like that. So
what happens if you try to overdraft?
So because it's a card, it just rejects the client at the register and no harm, no foul. So given that these cards give all of the access, including bank account numbers, which you can put, you know, you can buy things online, why are they not awesome things which we should be embracing as a way of, as a means of financial inclusion?
Okay, so we absolutely should be embracing them. And one of the things that I've tried to convince the post office to do is to roll out the debit card first, because they very well could just start by product by product. But the problem is that there's a wide range of debit cards, right? So there is the Bluebird, which is the best that you pointed out, and Walmart's giving this. But there's also, you know, the Magic Johnson card and the Rush card. And these are really expensive cards.
Yeah, there are definitely bad cards. And there are a couple of good ones. Bluebird is good, but it's an Amex, so it's not accepted everywhere. Chase Liquid is pretty good. Green Dot has a pretty good one. My favorite one is actually, and this is going to sound a little bit weird, Simple, which markets itself as a bank, but to all intents and purposes, basically what it is a prepaid debit card. And it's free. It costs absolutely nothing. It's got zero fees on anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. But I just want to also remind people that some of the worst prepaid debit cards, like the ones that are attached to like child support and custody hearings and things like that in court, are absolutely, they like charge $5 to check your balance, things like that. It's crazy. So
I think what's happening is that this is changing.
Yeah.
Is that virtually all of these cards now come with relatively sophisticated apps. You can do all of your balance checking and stuff on the app for free. If you look at the cards which you have to get if you get any kind of benefits in California, for instance, they're actually really good cards. And you know, for instance, all we really need to do is take those benefit cards, which everyone gets, and make them reloadable.
Can I bring up a question, which is actually a question I've been wanting to ask you. To what extent do we really want people not just to have savings, a way of spending their money, but to be able to access credit? Because it feels like...
So it's two different things.
Yeah.
And this is really important, is that financial inclusion in the first instance, you want to get there via some kind of depository institution, some kind of saving vehicle, a thrift, a savings bank, you know, a savings account, just something better than keeping cash under the mattress. Credit is incredibly important, and it's a different thing. And banks do both, and so they've kind of Eli did the two. And in fact, credit cards, you know, are weird. Like, you know, the same way that credit cards, if Eli did the concept of paying for something and borrowing money to pay for it,
right.
you do them at the same
time. But the prepaid
debit cards break that apart. It's just a way of saying it's a transaction thing without any kind of borrowing.
So I'm just like the putative person who has a prepaid debit card will be saving money because they're not paying all these extra fees.
Yeah.
But they're still payday lender customers because they sometimes have emergency needs.
Yes.
Yeah. It's absolutely two different needs. And transaction accounts, I don't understand how we can be in 2015 and have people that I go to my water office in Athens, Georgia, and there's a line of people that are waiting there during their lunch hour to pay their water bill. You know, I mean, in every government office that you go to, people have to pay their bills by cash because they live in this cash world. And I really do think we have a bifurcated transaction economy, right? We all operate in digital currency, right? We all have credit cards. Cash for me is like a cool thing that once in a while I have to pay, you know, for the fruit stand guy, but not something that
I
live in.
The classic tale of two cities. My friend Stefan lives in Sweden and for 2 years has never once touched Swedish currency. He uses no cash at all and has used no cash for 2 years. Meanwhile, I live next door to the Lower East Side People's Federal Credit Union, and the first thing you learn when you live next door to the Lower East Side People's Federal Credit Union is you never go there on the 1st or the 15th of the month because that's check day. And on check day, you get a line literally out the door of people who are taking their, you know, Social Security checks and cashing them in for bill payment. You know, they say, I need to pay some of this for this bill, some of this for this bill, some of this for this bill. They do it all at the teller. It takes forever. But that's how, you know, people will operate.
That's exactly right. And I think that's the other part about learning how the other half banks is that there is this whole cash economy here in the United States and a lot of the undocumented or the really low income. In fact, I had the same question from a woman from Denmark at a book event. She's like, why do Americans have cash? We essentially do not have cash in Denmark. And I asked her, well, do you have really poor people? And she's like, well, no, you know. So I do think that there is. And I lived in Harlem for a decade, too. And everything that we did, you know, in that community was in cash. And I think that there is this misunderstanding.
This is also the big problem with debit cards is that this is free. You go to Simple, everything is free for the best ones. Obviously, the worst ones are very expensive. But the one thing you can't do with a Simple debit card is take cash and put it into your card for free. You need to go to a bodega, buy a money pack. That's going to cost you $5 or $6. And this is why postal banking is so important and or Walmart banking and or some kind of banking at a kind of institution which deals in cash and you can interact in person because you need to be able to go into Walmart or the post office with cash and put it onto your debit card. If you can't do that, we don't really have a transaction.
You need brick and mortar.
I just want to come back to one of the problems, Marissa, you brought up regarding debit cards, that there are so many bad ones. Is the issue that even if we're starting to see more good actors in this space, more companies really like Simple, the bad has a habit of crowding out the good. I know in your book you mentioned that some of the worst tend to be the celebrity-backed ones, which obviously have the easiest time marketing
the
themselves.
The Kardashian card did close down.
That's thing.
There was a Kardashian.
Oh yeah, but like Russell, it was very bad.
Russell Simmons has gotten into some issues recently with this, with the Rush card.
The Rush card closed down in the worst possible way that you just couldn't access it for about 4 days.
And Susie Orman had her card.
Susie Orman.
Was hers any good?
It was pretty bad. I think it was a bad
and
one.
So,
that's just awful.
Shocking.
So to atrocious. Me, what it sounds like is the problem isn't just their efficacy, like in the best, like if you have the best possible version of the debit card, it's that a lot of people are going to get duped into taking out the worst possible version of a debit card.
Yeah, I mean, look, and the thing I try to point out in the book is we've got the low income having to deal in a pure market for credit and for financial services. So they have to pay whatever the market costs are and more. And so there's this competition. And I have people, entrepreneurs, call me all the time. And they tell me that the unbanked and the underbanked, that's like the golden egg. Everyone is trying to tap this market. This is a $90 billion financial services industry. And so there is this market competition. But the contrast is that those of us who have banks and the banks themselves do not operate in markets. The cost of credit is essentially zero. It is government provided. It is a public economy. And so why should the poor have to figure out whether Susie Orman's card is cheaper or the Bluebird? And the answer is the Bluebird. But, you know, they're paying market prices and more because payday loans aren't market prices. They're just the highest that they can charge.
So can we do a compromise and say a postal bank that issues a debit card that's as good as Bluebird?
Or better.
And that would be so easy.
And then everybody would know the postal bank. I trust the postal bank. I trust their payday.
The app would probably be pretty crappy because it would be healthcare.gov.
I have a question actually. Do you need legislation?
I was just going to say,
to issue a debit card?
No, I don't think so. So they already do money orders. There's a 2006 postal bill that said that the post office can't add anything else that they don't already have. And in 2006, they were issuing money orders. So look, I mean, if their regulator says okay and their regulator is on board, they could extend that to be debit cards.
That's fascinating because that would be an awesome workaround.
Exactly.
Because Congress
nobody
is Congress.
Wants to go to Congress.
And that would be and that would be the one the big holy grail for debit cards. The way that checking accounts make money is that the bank builds up a relationship with you. You know, everyone's heard this thing that you're more likely to get divorced than you are to change your bank. And you wind up staying with your bank for decades, even though you hate them because it's just such a pain to change banks. Prepaid debit cards are the exact opposite. You open up a prepaid debit card, you buy one at Walmart, you put money on it, you spend the money, you forget about it, you throw it away, you buy a new one. And the standard length of time, you know, for decades for a checking account is maybe a few weeks for a debit card. And the holy grail that everyone's trying to get to here is the prepaid debit card, which people keep for years and is actually a relationship which people where you can start making money over time.
And you could probably build a credit history, too.
Yes.
And the post office, I think, is uniquely capable of doing that.
Absolutely. I mean, look, people may, and you all said this before, you know, maybe it's a government, you know, it's a dinosaur, maybe it's inefficient. I happen to disagree, but it's not a shark. We trust the post office. We may not, you know, think that they're the most efficiently run organization. And I think it's a great organization. But I think, you know, we have warm feelings about the public nature of it. They're not going to screw us like, you know, Russell
Simmons
will.
Okay, so numbers round. Kathy, you're hula-ing.
Yes, I am. 83%. Boom.
Wow.
Yes.
It's one of my favorite numbers.
You guys read the amazing article about arbitration clauses.
That was my number. Oh.
Oh.
Not the 83%, but okay. Another one.
Okay.
Oh.
Okay.
Well, okay, we can share the subject. So in 2014 alone, so the basic thing is that people, whenever they get a job, whenever they use a product, they're signing these clauses saying they won't sue. They won't have class action lawsuits. They'll go into arbitration, and the theory was that it would give people some power against consumer fraud or what have you, but it doesn't look very good. In 2014, 83% of the time, judges upheld the class action bans. So that out of 162 cases, 134 times the judges were like, "No, sorry, you can't sue." And it's just one of those things.
I'm weeping for the class action lawyers here. The poor, poor class action lawyers. But Mercer, what's your number?
So I was just going to use the 9 words of the arbitration clause. I actually had 10 contract students send me this article because we talk about this case. It's not the class action lawyers that we should be weeping for. It's the people who get the overdraft fees. You know, it's like
it's very related to what we've been talking
exactly.
about.
Exactly. So you get these overdraft fees and you know that there's something that they're doing that's wrong or against the contract or whatever. But you're not motivated to sue because it's such a small sum and you can't then join a class to, you know, sue Bank of America. So
basically,
a huge problem.
Unless you have like a more than $5,000 damage to yourself, it's like never going to be worth it.
Exactly.
Right?
And so these bad actors can keep doing what they're doing and not worry about any lawsuits.
I feel that regulation through class action suits is one of the most inefficient conceivable ways of regulating anything.
But it's one of the few ways Americans traditionally have been willing to regulate
anything. Let me put it this way. The threat that we would sue at least kept them from being bald-faced about the ways they're screwing their customers.
Yeah, and your previous guest, Matt Levine in Bloomberg, has written about the Bank of America settlement about these overdraft fees, where this guy took out, you know, overdraft, and the Bank of America charged him like a $35 fee for like 6 days in a
row. And that was a settlement with the regulator. You didn't need a class action suit for that.
Yeah, but how many people are actually going to go
for it? You need the threat, right?
No, I mean, the regulator is a threat. Anyway, that's a whole other segment. Jordan, what's your number?
I'll still be around to defend the class action orders. Don't worry. But anyway, so my number is $296,000. This is from a recent Bank of America report that Bloomberg wrote a story on. I should preface this by saying this isn't... So basically, Bank of America wanted to look at who has benefited more from QE and low interest rates. American
QE
people.
QE is quantitative easing.
Yeah, quantitative easing.
For those following along at home.
Really easy monetary policy, right? And who has benefited more, the American people or American financiers and, you know, stockholders, et cetera? And the number, the headline number they picked out was, for every one job that was created over the past decade, companies have spent $296,000 buying back stock. And it's just like, I say this as someone who basically supports what the Fed has been doing, but it does show that in a lot of ways, low interest rates have benefited corporations or benefit stockholders in that it's created very, very cheap money that can then be borrowed and used to, you know, plump up share values.
Wait,
basically.
I just had this brilliant question, brilliant idea that I'm going to pose as a question, which is, can a postal bank do direct quantitative easing?
Oh, just like a money drop?
Yeah, just make it easy to borrow money.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about it as a central bank for the poor.
Borrowed. Like, you could do it. You could actually do a Ben Bernanke helicopter drop.
Exactly.
And then one day, every single person with a postal bank account wakes up with $500 in their bank account.
A zero interest $500 loan.
No, it's not a loan. It's just a credit. It's just your money.
It's capital.
Either way, my point being, like, right now we don't have that many tools to do quantitative easing.
It's called an unconditional cash transfer. It's very trendy these days in developing markets. Okay, finally, my number this week, just because it jumped out at me for no particular reason, is $6.1 billion, which is the annual revenue of QVC.
What is that?
QVC is the home shopping network.
Oh my god!
Television.
You've never indulged.
She's not over 70.
It is one of my favorite television channels. But more to the point, there's this wonderful article about it where QVC is by far the most digitally sophisticated television channel in the world, pretty much. And because phoning up a number and staying on hold and talking to a human being and, like, who wants to do that? They have really optimized for people downloading the QVC app while they're watching the television and just press a button on their phone and whatever's being talked about on the television just gets delivered automatically to their house. It's the most amazing technology.
I just had another brilliant idea also being posed as a question. Felix, if they invited you to be on the QVC channel...
I would... Well, in a heartbeat.
Wait, Felix, what would you be hawking? Like, what would you be selling?
Watches.
Or wait...
I will
maybe
sell,
that trunk club.
No, it has
thing.
To be something really weird.
I will sell absolutely anything on QVC. I love them so much.
QVC, you heard. If anybody has any connections to QVC,
get
any
me
listeners
on
out there,
it'll be like a record breaker.
I will plug anything.
Yeah, seriously, get thee to cable.
Okay, that is it for us this week. Thank you for listening to Slate Money. If you liked it, do subscribe to us. You can find us by searching for Slate Money in the iTunes store. Leave a review there and send us your questions, your comments, your concerns, your limericks. We like limericks. The email address is slatemoney@slate.com. Many thanks to Audrey Quinn, the producer, to Andy Bowers, the executive producer, and most especially to Mercer Baradaran, whose book, How the Other Half Banks, is available in all good booksellers now. Slate Money is part of the Panoply Network. Check out everything at itunes.com/panoply, and we'll talk to you next week on Slate Money.